You're listening to Midwest Vegan Radio.
We're sharing all our secrets.
We're sharing all of our secrets just for you special listeners.
With your hosts, Dallas.
That sounds so good.
And Ryan.
Pass the noosh.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome to Midwest Vegan Radio again.
So let's get right into it. I'm Ryan.
I'm Dallas.
Elliot's over there.
Hello.
So today we're going to be talking about interpersonal violence in the animal rights movement.
And also probably like manipulation and abuses that aren't.
That's why I said interpersonal rather than, I mean, there's sexual violence, sure, but there's also, I mean, there's sexism and, you know, like entrenched issues, but I don't know. I kind of feel like interpersonal violence is a good way to sum all of that up. Because it really is about when one person is controlling and manipulating and abusing another person. And this is something that, you know, it's just, there's a lot of misconception around it. There's a lot of people are uncomfortable talking about it, or they're afraid to talk about it, or they, you know, they think that if we acknowledge that this is a reality, that it will damage our movement somehow, or they're just in denial and they don't believe that anybody who is in the animal rights movement could possibly have anything, could possibly be someone who could have issues in another area of their life that isn't animal rights that needs work. I think it's really important that we talk about this stuff. So, and Ryan agrees. And
so I agree.
We're going to talk about it. There've been a number of things that have come up over the past, I don't know, year or so that have gotten me more committed to raising this issue. And I feel like I haven't done that so much just because I have so much going on in my life. And this is, it's not something that I tend to deal with on a daily basis or anything, but it does exist. And there are not enough people talking about it. Not enough people, willing to
stand up and be honest.
Yeah. Stand up and like actually be somebody who has the spot. I don't know. You know, be somebody who's brave enough to say, hey, I'm going to take a stand on this issue.
I want to say too, I think part of our reasoning for wanting to talk about this and for really bringing up the importance of this is recently, and our product review will be about this, but we read for the Animal Rights Coalition book group, Patrice Jones' Aftershock, which talks a lot about the violence within these different social justice movements. And obviously that relates for us to the animal rights movement and how icky that can be. And I mean, and more so than, I think let's just come out and say, this is kind of, take this as an example. Okay. So you are new to maybe this movement, and I, through a series of events, meet Elliot, and Elliot is, you know, I look up to him. He's well known within the animal rights community. He's a big name, and I'm sorry to paint you as the bad guy, but you're a male and you're there. So ta-da. But you know, and I think Elliot is this awesome guy. Maybe he's, you know, he's a producer for a vegan radio show. He, you know, he does all these different things. And so he's well known and well respected within the animal rights community. And Elliot and I hang out. And I think, you know, violence against women or manipulation or, you know, date rape, things like that are really icky, tricky things to get into anyway. But, you know, maybe we've had a couple of drinks or maybe we haven't. And, you know, something happens and I don't think it's right. And, you know, but because Elliot's in the animal rights movement and he's a big name, like, who's going to believe? First of all, you know, when I think with rape victims, they're worried oftentimes about being believed anyway.
Oh,
but who's going to believe that this guy who everybody likes did this to them? And who can I possibly tell? I don't want to lose all my friends that are in the movement. I don't, you know, it's such a gross spot for anybody that's had violence or very serious manipulation perpetrated against them. What do you even do?
Yeah.
How do you even stand up for yourself in these situations?
Well, I mean, it's hard. It's hard for most people who are in those situations to, I mean, first of all, recognizing it can be difficult. So there's not enough education about what abuse looks like.
Not always physical.
Right. I mean, I guess it's an abuse of power, but I experienced some pretty, blatant sexism in a group that I used to be involved with. And I didn't recognize it for a long time because I just didn't think it was possible. I thought that, oh, there must be something wrong with me. I must be misinterpreting this, or maybe I'm just being too sensitive, or because all of these people are, they're animal rights people. Like they know that that's a problem, and they've, all the talk was there, but the actions weren't lining up with that. And so even just acknowledge, recognizing that that is happening can be difficult. And then certainly nobody wants to believe that somebody that they admire or somebody that they identify with, maybe even if they don't admire them, but they feel like, oh, that person is part of my clan or part of my tribe or part of my community. And what would it say about me if I didn't catch on, if I didn't notice something, maybe there's something wrong. I mean, there's a lot of different issues that come up with it. The other thing I do want to point out too, though, is that it's not just about men abusing women. It's anybody. Women can abuse men. Women can abuse women. Men can abuse men. So, it can be, and it doesn't have to be just sexual either, but, any kind of manipulation, power, control, situation where one person feels powerless or scared, intimidated or threatened, in any way, like that's unhealthy and it's not okay. And it's not, and it absolutely happens. Like there are actually people that I've had conversations with that do not believe that that happens in the animal rights movement but it happens in every social justice movement, and it will happen as long as we live in a society that's based on hierarchy or, it's going to happen. And the thing is that we have to acknowledge that it exists before we can figure out how to deal with it. But if we just pretend like it doesn't exist, then we're not going to get anywhere in terms of dealing with it. And that isn't fair. It's not fair to, victims or survivors. And it's definitely not fair to activists or to animals even, because, the animals already have so few people who are really working on their behalf, And, personally, I feel that, I feel that abuse should be taken just as seriously as snitching should be, in terms of, snitching is a big deal in terms of, communities where there is illegal action happening or there's something at stake in government spying and all of that. Like somebody who snitches on another activist, is ostracized. I mean, they are not trusted anymore. And essentially, like, there is a community punishment. Like, there are consequences for behaving that way. And I feel like, instead, just as many times when somebody comes forward to say, when they come forward and say, hey, I feel like I've been abused, there's victim blaming that happens. That happens in dominant culture as well. But in any event, the other thing that happens too is that oftentimes people will say, oh, well, that's really just between you guys.
Yeah.
That's just between you two. I don't want to get involved in that. That's your personal stuff. And that doesn't have anything to do with the work that we're doing in our collective or the work that we're doing in our group or our community or our movement. Like that is it. There's this, myth or this lie that is abuse is separate from what it is that we're working on. We're working on animal rights. So domestic violence or, other forms of abuse that doesn't fall under animal abuse, but in fact it does, because people are animals and it directly impacts that work.
Go ahead and finish.
No, I'm on a rant. You just interrupt.
I'd kind of like to say too, how difficult it can be to even perceive when something's happening to you. This didn't happen in an AR context, but I had a work situation where I was out in the warehouse, and this guy was, who I've noticed whenever I see him, kind of leers at me, and I was out in on his turf, and he seemed kind of like he was leering at me again, and he walked past me and brushed into me and ended up touching my butt, and in a space where there was, he had plenty of room to not bump into me, and it took me, you know, I was so taken aback by it that it's like, is that sexual harassment? Fuck yes, that is. Like, he had no business touching me. But if I would have, and of course in the moment, like, I didn't say anything. I was like, did that actually just happen? I was more surprised that actually happened.
Yeah.
Like, did that really happen? And I know that's not nearly as serious as, you know, having your sexuality violated, you know, or having violence perpetrated against you. But I was just so surprised that he even did that. And of course I went back to my desk and I'm just like, oh my God, here's what I should have said. I should have been like, excuse me or whatever. And at which point he would have been like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to, which
could have been a
did
lie.
Did he mean to? Did, yeah. I don't know. Yeah. And so sometimes it can be really tricky at first to determine what's really going on. And if, I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I do. Yeah. And that's something that's really common too, is that sometimes it takes people a while before they feel like they have the courage or the support or whatever it is to come forward and say, hey, something happened.
But now I won't go anywhere near that guy. And if he ever does anything like that again, I'm going to punch his lights out.
Oh, that's you?
Yeah.
Talking about your work
experience?
That's
me personally.
Okay.
Yes. Sorry.
But yeah, I mean, and that is, again, there's nothing wrong. You know, it's not a victim's fault if they don't feel safe coming forward and telling somebody, you know, what happened until way after the fact, or, you know, like immediate. I don't know what I'm trying to say exactly, but I guess I just get really, really sickened by the victim blaming culture that we live in terms of, you know, any kind of abuse really, but, you know, looking at even those stereotypes about rape, like, oh, she was asking for it. You know, she shouldn't have been in that bad neighborhood at that time of night. She shouldn't have been wearing those things. You know, she shouldn't have provoked some, no.
Shouldn't have even gone into, you know, she shouldn't have gone into that guy's room with him if she didn't want to.
Yeah.
But that's such bullshit.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you think is owed to you if you're someone that's going to perpetrate sexual violence or violence at all on somebody. Just because I go into a hotel room with Elliot or I'm at his place and I go into his room with him or something like that doesn't mean that that gives him the right to do whatever he wants. Like, if for whatever reason I get uncomfortable with how things are progressing or whatever, if I say no, that should be the end of it.
Yep.
That's it.
And I don't...
Let me say, Elliot is not a creep at all, and I'm sorry for using you as an example.
Speak yeah. Yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Really
okay. Not. Maybe Elliot's totally a creep. I don't know.
But
I'm sorry.
I mean, it comes back to, and this is an animal rights issue. Consent is an animal rights issue.
Yes, definitely.
It absolutely is completely wound up in each other. I mean, we talk all the time about animals who have violence perpetrated against them unwillingly. You know, they are killed. They do not, you know, dance onto the slaughterhouse floor and bare their necks.
Oh, really?
For the knife. No. You know, animals are...
That was my understanding.
We talk about, you know, being angry that animals are raped. We talk about, you know, how it's not... all of these things.
And before
people
are thinking of bestiality, that's actually how mammals are impregnated. So they're... The industry term, especially for dairy cows, is a rape rack. That's the industry term.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I just didn't want people to think, like, bestiality when you say animals are
oh,
raped.
Oh, yeah. I guess I took that for granted that people would know. Thank you. But in any event, I mean, we talk about these things in terms of what we are furious about happening to animals, but then when it happens to our own people in our own community... to deny it or to blame them for it is so hypocritical. And frankly, It's speciesist. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. Like, oh, because you're human, I don't give a crap about what happens to you. Like, that is speciesism. And it really makes me angry that... it makes me angry that this is, I mean, of course, any kind of abuse and unnecessary violence and all of that makes me angry. But I think that I was talking with somebody about this earlier, but just that I'm really used to being angry about animal issues. Like, I'm used to it. I'm used to that kind of feeling of disgust. And I think that I get a little bit more riled up about this topic because it's not something that I'm used to yet. Which,
and it's not well handled.
No, it isn't well handled.
They're just, and I kind of can understand violence and sexual violence when you are accusing somebody of that is very serious.
Mm-hmm.
You're taking someone's reputation down, but that doesn't give them an excuse. And I know that in media situations, and there are always exceptions where there certainly can be people that are looking to cash in on exploiting people in a reverse sort of way, using their own alleged vulnerability and sexuality to accuse people of things that they didn't do for fame or money or whatever. But those are so the exception, and women and men too. I'm certain this happens to men. Victims are so often not believed, mm-hmm. and that doesn't make them want to come forward anymore. I'm sure that the numbers of people that have violence and sexual violence perpetrated against them are so much lower than, or so much higher than what's reported,
yeah.
because people just don't want to come forward. They don't.
Well, why would you? I mean,
who would believe you? And the trauma of having to relive this in, you know, potential court situations and having to come out and have everybody know that this happened to you mm-hmm. is really, I mean, it can be shameful. It can make you feel shameful, which is sad. It shouldn't, but
that's part of because it's stigmatized.
Yeah.
And you know, because of the victim blaming and all of that. And the other thing too, I mean, if somebody comes out and says, I was abused by another activist, they are essentially, I mean, they're facing potential backlash from their own community, you mm-hmm. know, from the people that essentially they, you know, these are people who should understand you or have your back or be supportive of you in ways that you can't get elsewhere.
Right.
And that's a huge, I think there are definitely instances where, you know, that people end up having to either stuff it so that they don't lose their community or, you know, say something and risk losing all of this, I don't know, this community and passion and cause, you know,
at the risk of not being believed anyway and losing it for allegedly for nothing.
Right. And so that, I mean, it just is a really, really crappy situation. And in terms of, and then, you know, I guess that it kind of goes along with, why people don't want to get involved in it either, because it's messy and it's difficult. And it reminds me a lot of a book that I relied on heavily for an essay that I wrote, called Trauma and Recovery by Judith Herman. And it's like one of the most well-known books about trauma, out there. And she wrote a lot about rape victims and a lot about post-traumatic stress disorder and veterans and things like that. But she had something in there that was very clearly broken down. And in any instance where there is violence or a trauma that happens, there are three different parties involved, three different roles that can be taken. One is the victim, so somebody who has violence perpetrated against them. Two is the perpetrator, the person who is perpetrating the violence. And three is the witness. And the witness is anybody. They don't have to actually physically be there. They don't actually have to physically hear or see anything. The witness can also be someone whom the victim comes to and says, this happened. And I, in my in my animal rights essay, I talked about how, you know, we animal rights activists are witnesses to animal abuse who are the victims, right? And so it is up to us in terms, you know, how to, we advocate on behalf of that victim. The witness has the choice. They have to decide whether they're going to side with the victim or the perpetrator. It's very easy to side with the perpetrator because all that requires is doing nothing.
Yeah,
it requires exactly. pretending like nothing's wrong. It requires pretending like you didn't see it and you're not going to get involved. It's a lot more difficult to get involved and take the witness or take the victim's side because that requires action and it requires being present and it requires standing up and actually defending, you know, taking a stand and confronting something that's wrong.
Right.
And that is difficult. It's hard to do that. And so I understand why a lot of people don't want to go there. And I understand why there's the denial in our movement about abuse in this culture and all of that, but it's not an excuse. And I think, if people, you know, can understand the dynamics of violence, understand the dynamics of abuse and how it works. The other thing too, that Judith Herman wrote about that I thought was really wonderfully put is about what the perpetrator will do when they're threatened, you know, when they're threatened with being exposed, that they will do everything that they can to silence and discredit the victim.
Oh, absolutely.
And you see that in the animal rights movement. You know, you see that with industry and government repression of activists. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, we're ridiculed. You know, people, they try to put us in prison. They try to, you know, they try to destroy our reputations and, you know, get people to, you know, dismiss us as crazy. That happens. And it happens the same exact way.
It does.
And so in terms of like individual violence between people. And so, you know, I just wish that people could make these connections and see that, you know, that, okay, somebody's trying to, you know, if somebody who's accused of being a perpetrator starts behaving like one, you know, yeah. like I wish that there were people who could recognize that and say, oh, wow, this is classic perpetrator behavior. Not to say that that's necessarily, and the other thing too that really is frustrating about this these situations is that oftentimes people want they want to demand proof. I want to see proof that this happened. And unfortunately, you know, most people who perpetrate violence or batterers or whatever they're not dumb.
Right.
You know, they're not going to be doing this in situations where, you know, it's going to be obvious.
Or, yeah.
I mean, this is going to be happening in private. This is going to be, you know.
Or very subtly if it's done in front of other people.
Subtly,
I was going to say, too, you know, I think that we all have sort of like, you know, some kind of skeletons or things in our closet. We've all done things we're not proud of or, you know, lied about something or whatever. And so it's really easy for people, for perpetrators to go back and blame victim and say, well, you know, this person, look at their character. I mean, you know, it's easy for for somebody to say, look at Ryan's past. There's no way she's telling the truth because she's done this and she's, you know, whatever. Or look at Elliot's past or look at Dallas's past. We've all done things where, presumably, where people could go back and use that against us.
Oh, absolutely.
And our character.
But
which is really shitty.
Okay. Well, and even if, so you say about, you know, even if a victim has something in their past or an ally of a victim has something in their past that a perpetrator may use to try to discredit them or whatever, or say, hey, you know, you can't believe them or they deserved it or whatever it is, no matter who this person is, it doesn't, you know, ultimately everybody is responsible for their own behavior. So, you know, going back to the she asked for it kind of idea, everybody's responsible for their own behavior. It doesn't matter if somebody, you know, has a history of lying or whatever the deal. I mean, it does matter because people need to take everything into consideration when being faced with this information or, you know, an allegation. It does matter, but it doesn't mean that it can't be true.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't take it seriously and that you shouldn't do everything you can to behave appropriately as someone who has been approached about something very serious and wrong.
I don't think most people, most mentally competent people, would bring a situation like this on themselves if it didn't happen. In the real world, of course, as previously mentioned, you know, celebrity type stuff. There's certainly weirdos out there. But nobody in their right mind is going to go through the trouble of, or the risk of being completely ostracized by all of their friends and their community, losing everything and all of their friends, and possibly having to go to court and deal with all these painful things if it didn't happen. Just because Dallas pissed me off one day, I'm not going to claim that she assaulted me. You know what I mean? That just doesn't happen over petty little.
And the thing is, too, things. That from what I understand, generally, the reason that that people do come forward and actually say something isn't even because of their own experience. It's because they're afraid that this might happen to someone else if they don't say something.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, again, that's very telling that, you know, that's usually why people are willing to take that risk and suffer through all of this, you know, all of the emotional trauma that goes along with coming out, about being abused, because, you know, you're trying to prevent this from happening again to someone else.
I'm going to share an extremely personal story, Dallas. I think you know what I'm going to say. I actually used to date a guy a long time ago, and I'm not going to say any names, but at one point during our relationship, I found child pornography on his computer, and it was a very serious situation, and I was really afraid to. I obviously told him that I found it, but I was afraid to tell people, and I was afraid to report it, and it wasn't until a few years later, obviously we broke up, and when I found out that he had a child with another woman, was when I finally came up with the nerve to report it, because I was afraid for this child. And when I was talking earlier about feelings of shame, I mean, how shameful it was for me to have dated somebody that, like, knowingly had child pornography on their computer, which is so, like, that's hard to watch, like, like, you know, some of the animal. So, like, you lose a piece of yourself that you never get back when you see that kind of exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, but it took me about 3 years. And of course, I'm sure that he'd probably, I don't know if he still had it or if he was still involved in that. I don't know. But I felt so shameful. I just.
What, that you didn't, you couldn't catch it, or.
I felt shameful that I was even with somebody.
Yeah.
That was involved in that. I felt like a dirty, horrible person. And then even coming forward, I was very nervous about it, because I was afraid, you know, what if they catch him? What if he comes after me? What, you know, like all sorts of weird sorts of things about that. It was a really weird.
Well, and that's situation. Part of it. And that's a very real concern, because, you know, if somebody is being violent, you know, being violent in whatever way, they've demonstrated that they don't have a problem.
I also want to say, too, that this guy was an absolute charmer. And don't think for one second when I told my friends that they believed me. I mean, my friends, who all knew him and liked him very much, didn't. I mean, he had a roommate that had children that didn't want to believe me.
Yeah.
You know, you don't make stuff like that up for fun.
Yeah. Well, and I guess, I mean, this kind of, we could tie it in, and we'll talk about this in another episode in more depth, but it goes back to this notion of how we approach animal rights and how we approach animal liberation as a movement, whether it's something that we view as a single issue you know, project. Like, we're going to take care of animal rights stuff and then we'll deal with sexism or, you know,
right,
capitalism or whatever the thing is. But really, all of these issues are connected.
They are all tied
intimately just completely inextricably connected. You cannot untangle this. You know, if you are working on behalf of helping animals, yeah, I mean, that includes the environment, it includes workers' rights, it includes, you know, I don't know, class issues, mm-hmm, and health and all, I mean, all of this, it's all kind of connected, but this is, it's all the same dynamics. It's exactly, violence is violence.
Right.
Trauma is trauma. And, you know, saying that, you know, my pet issue is the only one that matters, that isn't helpful. And the other thing too, that makes me angry, when people in the animal rights movement behave in ways that essentially demonstrate that the well-being of our own community members isn't important, it reinforces a negative stereotype that animal rights people don't care about people.
Right.
That they only care about animals. And that is a huge, I mean, that's a thing we encounter all the time. I mean, any demo you go to, you're going to get one person who yells at you about why do you care about animals more than people?
Mm-hmm.
And
because you're not capable of caring about two things at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. But that is that's crappy because we're accused of that. And it makes me really angry that there are people in our movement who are proving those assholes right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sucks. And I really think that we need to be more thoughtful. I mean, yeah, it does require more, literally more thought. We have to think about how everything works together. We've got to be smarter. We've got to be, more savvy in general. And I understand that, you know, compassion fatigue, I understand feeling like you just don't have the energy to take on every evil in the world. And I'm not saying that everybody should, but I am saying that just because you're not going to take on every single evil in the world doesn't mean that you can't be a decent person who does the right thing, you know, and tries to support someone if they come to you and says, I've been abused or I've been hurt or something happened to me that's wrong. Certainly, you know,
and think of how much courage it took for them to do that.
Yeah, that's a huge thing. And it's a compliment. It should be a compliment to you. And if you violate that's really crappy.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I'm reading a book right now. I'm in the middle of it. It's called The Revolution Starts at Home. It's like Confronting Interpersonal Violence in Activist Communities, something like that. But The Revolution Starts at Home. And it's fantastic. It doesn't address at least since I've been working through it, it doesn't address everything in as much detail as I wish it would. There's no talk about the animal rights community at all so far. It's been mostly like integration or, what's the word? Immigration.
Oh,
immigration issues and a lot of, like queer and trans community stuff and, class issues and, you know, it's a lot of other kinds of social justice efforts that they're describing problems in, but it's still the same idea,
mm-hmm,
you know, that you're in a community where you think everybody's going to behave ethically. And that's just not true.
Nope.
Just because somebody's vegan or just because somebody is an animal rights person doesn't mean that they can't be abusive in a different context.
Right.
You know, they can't. Again,
or
we
even
all,
just a jerk in general.
Or a jerk in general. It's true. I mean, we all have things that we need to work on. You know, I have to deal with internalized racism issues, and I acknowledge that. If you don't acknowledge it, you can't address it and work forward on it. You know, I've got class privilege that I want to be aware of so, mm-hmm, that I don't abuse that. Like, that, everybody has something that they need to work on. Nobody is perfect.
Well, I'm perfect.
I forgot.
Yeah.
In any event, I mean, this is not just, I basically what I'm saying is educate yourself a little bit about abuse. Like, don't pretend like this doesn't exist. And somebody may come to you at some point and say, you know, I've been hurt, and you'll be happy that you did a little bit of reading on it, or, you know, have some clue of what to do. But a lot of it is common sense kinds of things, being sensitive, being somebody who's safe, a safe person to talk to, and all of that. One book. So The Revolution Starts at Home is one. Trauma and Recovery by Judith Herman was the other one I talked about. Also, we mentioned Aftershock by Patrice Jones. Wonderful, wonderful book. It's the subtitle for that one is Confronting Trauma in a Violent World, a Guide for Activists and Their Allies. The first two-thirds of the book is written for activists, and the last third of the book is written for psychologists or therapists. So if you have an issue around activism that you want to get professional help with, this is a great book to be able to take to a professional therapist and say, hey, can you please look at this book so that you have some idea of how to approach working with me?
Yeah, because that's a really annoying thing about being in a specific movement or even, you know, into any sort of alternative thing where you're discussing issues around it with a therapist and they don't even know what you're talking about.
And then you end up paying them to teach them.
Right.
You know, you're spending your time with them, like explaining things, doing basically outreach for $150 an hour or whatever. Right. It's ridiculous. So Aftershock can help expedite that process. So that's all good. And that's pretty much, you know, what I've got to say on the issue. I'm glad we could talk about it. If you have something to say on this, please do, like, send us a note. Let us know what you think, because there's not enough people talking about it, and we'd love to have your feedback on this particular issue. So can we have a transition?
We can. Did you? I think we should transition to our product review, which is
Aftershock?
Yeah.
Well, I kind of thought we did most of it. Do you have anything to say on that?
I thought the book was really interesting and I liked it.
Yeah, I have four copies and I regularly lend them to people and buy them for people. It's one, I mean, I just think it's an incredible, incredible book.
I gave away my copy.
I don't know what there's anything else to say. I mean, about it, we kind of went there with it really, but it's fantastic. Definitely check it out. It's good.
So never mind that portion of
well,
our episode,
we covered it. Okay. Just two more things. One, there's a fantastic essay that came out. Absolutely brilliant essay. It's by Melanie Joy. M-E-L-A-N-I-E. Melanie Joy, and she has written a couple of books. She wrote Strategic Action for Animals, and she wrote...
And how do you spell Joy? Just kidding.
J-O-Y. There's no silent P's or anything in
there. Oh, good. Okay. Thanks.
She wrote Strategic Action for Animals, and she also wrote Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. And basically in that book, she brought forth a new word or new term, and it's called carnism. And basically carnism is the ideology or the belief system that says that it is okay or that it is right to eat animals. Right?
Right.
So because, vegetarianism or veganism there, it's clear that that's based on an ideology. It's a set of beliefs and principles. So in any event, that was clear, but she actually named carnism, which was an invisible one. And that's usually what happens in dominant culture, is whatever is dominant isn't named. So she named it, and described it. And in this article that she put out,
and it's on, onegreenplanet.org. One is spelled out.
Yep.
O-N-E.
And we'll link to it from the website. And it's also on our Facebook page. Went out immediately on the Facebook page after it came out.
Yeah.
And I read it and fell in love. But what is the title of the article?
It's called Understanding Neocarnism, How Vegan Advocates Can Appreciate and Respond to quote-unquote happy meat, locavorism, and paleo dieting, quote-unquote paleo dieting.
So basically, in this article, she is able to address some of the more common arguments or justifications that people make for eating animals. People who are, I don't know, consider themselves to be more ethical or consider themselves to be more thoughtful. And really they are more thoughtful than the average person. even though they're not coming to the conclusion that we, you know, want them to come to yet. But so neocarnism is like the new carnism idea. And what's paleo dieting?
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't familiar with that term. Basically, what paleo dieting is it's this idea that you're going back to hunter-gatherer days or something, you know, the hunter-gatherer diet. It's just, I don't know, maybe less processed foods, more whole foods or something, but it still includes eating animals. So she basically combats the three N's that she names as well, for people who come up with excuses or justifications for eating animals. And that is that eating animals is
normal,
natural and necessary. And these are things that come up. People will, you know, I'm guessing that if you're vegan and you're listening to this podcast, somebody has brought one of these issues up to you at some point. And she breaks it all down and gives essentially like tips on ideas on how to counter those various arguments. And I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic.
It's a really well-written, very interesting article.
And timely and, I mean, really useful. So it's practical. There's a practical application for it. So definitely check it out. It's totally worth the read and awesome. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Melanie, for writing something great again.
Yes, again.
All right. Anything else on that one?
No.
Okay. Green Challenge.
It's time for the Green Challenge.
Green Challenge.
Green Challenge.
There's no gloves. There's no swords.
No white suits.
Uh-uh. It's just Green Challenge.
You're just doing the earth a solid.
Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
All right. Let's do it.
I don't know what it is.
Something really simple. It's kind of like, oh, we're going to talk about all this heavy stuff. And then, so my Green Challenge for this time is it kind of actually, I don't know if other people are having financial concerns these days, especially right now. There's all these issues. I mean, Minnesota, we came out of it, but there was a government shutdown in Minnesota and it was mm-hmm. a big deal. And all these 22,000 people were out of work. And nationally, we've got the Tea Party, you know, basically holding our government hostage or something over the debt ceiling or something. Our global economy is on the verge of collapse.
Crap on the news about apparently, that, so they couldn't do it.
Yeah, apparently people are going to be thinking about money in a new way pretty soon. Hopefully we won't fall into a national depression. But
Again.
But it got me thinking a little bit about oftentimes doing things in a more environmental way is also a way to think about save, you know, it will save you money. Or vice versa. If you're thinking about saving money and you're trying to figure out how to do that, you may stumble across ways to be more green,
mm-hmm.
which is how I came upon.
They kind of go hand in hand sometimes.
They do. So this is, you know, in the Depression area, to think about people who, maybe you have a grandparent who lived through the Depression and they keep every scrap of tin foil, you know, and all of that kind of thing.
Dallas is making weird hand gestures right now.
I'm folding imaginary tin foil into pieces. But so laundry. There's this thing, it's a lint trap, I guess it's called. It's like a wire mesh sock or something that you put over the pipe that shoots water out from the washing machine. Maybe I have an old washing machine, I don't know, but I've seen this. It's been in most washing machines that I've seen in places I've lived or growing up and whatever, and we have one now. And it will fill up with lint, and then generally, usually I would just take that off and toss it in the trash and put a new one on. But instead, now I've been taking, like, actually turning it inside out and, like, getting the lint out of it and then putting it back on with a zip tie.
Mm-hmm.
And I am kind of amazed with how many times I can reuse one and, you know, save money. This is kind of my, because I just don't like the fact that I need to spend money on this thing that I don't feel like I should have to spend money on. It's a weird expense. It's like one of those household expenses that I just don't ever
like
factor in.
Filters or
yeah, I just don't factor it in to my general thinking of like how much things will cost. Like I forget about tabs on my car and stuff like that. I just don't, oh wow, that's gonna cost money that I wasn't anticipating spending, or you know, but it's one of these boring little invisible pieces of life that you have to deal with. So, I've actually gotten a lot of mileage out of these things, and then all, you know, they're metal. And so technically like that should be something that could be recycled,
mm-hmm.
but I've been throwing them in the trash because I guess that's just what people, I don't know, I just presumed people did. But I kind of feel, it feels a little funny, like digging, I don't know, it feels, I feel like a Depression era grandma, but that's cool. I mean, I knit.
Well, that's exactly how people see you.
So. I'd like to learn to can, you know, all that kind of stuff. I don't think it's.
Oh my gosh. I have to tell you, my friend Chelsea is in-law family, who would never listen to this podcast, so that doesn't matter, but they can these pickles that are out of control.
Out of control. They're bananas.
Yes, they're bananas, but they're pickles. Not bananas, but the pickles are bananas. For one of her baby showers, it was at her in-law's place, and I, like, convinced them to give me a jar of them, because they were serving them as part of the food.
Yeah.
And I convinced them to let me take one home, and it was gone by the end of the day. It was their... Oh,
I totally want to learn how to can.
I know, me too.
I'd love to do that. At the farmer's market today, there was a woman who had a whole setup about that, and I really wanted to stop, but I had to get to a Petland protest, so I didn't have time to talk about canning. But, I would love to hear from our listeners if you have...
Someone come show us how to can, and we'll do a video podcast about it.
Oh, yeah, that'd be pretty cool. But I would also like to hear from listeners about if you have ways that you were thinking about how to save money, and then you stumbled on a green thing. Because a lot of times people will say, oh, you know, I would be more environmental, but I can't afford it. Like, I can't afford to buy...
Solar panels.
Yeah, solar panels, or a hybrid car, or, you know, whatever it is. Like, or even biodegradable garbage bags or whatever. You know, a lot of times this stuff is more expensive. But honestly, I think that there are a lot of things we could be doing that would save us money.
I actually cringe every time I buy my Method laundry soap.
Because it's expensive?
It's so expensive. It's like $15 for the regular size. They have a small one that's like $8, but every time I buy it, I cringe, but I'm like, oh, I can't buy something else. It'll just make me angry.
Yeah. Well, so I want to hear from you if you've got ideas, because do you have ideas?
You know, actually, I do have one idea. So I do at Moksha Yoga in Minneapolis. I'm part of the Energy Exchange Program, so I work there, and then in turn I don't have to pay for yoga classes, and we actually clean the windows with vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
So you, instead of like buying hazardous toxic chemical cleaning products, yep, you could put vinegar in a water bottle.
And you can use newspaper.
Yep. The towels that we use there, Moksha is very, very green. That's kind of one of their things. But they have like these ShamWow type towels that they use. But yeah, we actually clean with vinegar, and it doesn't
good.
Smell bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it smells bad, but it's not like you don't notice it really.
Yeah.
So.
Cool. Vinegar on your windows. But yeah, I want to hear more. So email.
Yeah. Email us at MidwestVeganRadio@gmail.com, or please Facebook, like our Facebook fan page.
Like our Facebook fan page. We like that when you
And actually, as we're kind of wrapping up here, I put a note out on our fan page that we're recording right now. And, you know, if you want to get in a little shout out, and we had a couple of people write. So, Chris Ann, our friend Chris Ann, said we should give a shout out to Melissa Swanson, who just finished a triathlon today, and she's a super vegan athlete. So, yay, Melissa, good job.
She totally is.
And
we're in the Twin Cities, so it's St. Paul, Minneapolis.
Yeah.
She lives in St. Paul, and sometimes she's like, oh, I can just run over to Minneapolis, and she means it, like on her feet.
Yeah, she does.
She will run
over. I've been up at the Animal Rights Coalition at Ethique Nouveau, and she's like, ran, and it was winter.
Yeah. She'll run like 12 miles just to come and, I don't know,
crazy.
Buy a caramel. That's bananas.
That is bananas. Okay. Jennifer K. Cortez, who is one of the co-owners of the Hive Salon, also wrote to us, and she wanted to toot her own horn, saying that she is making what just may be the world's best vegan black bean burger. So I'm going to say, prove it. Prove it.
Prove it.
You should eat them on the show.
Exactly.
Yeah. We could do an on-location recording at Hive and eat black bean burgers.
That's what we should do.
What do you think, Jennifer? Let us know.
And lastly, Mark Shepard wanted, this is more of a call to action. I was a little bit confused at first, but he wanted us to give a shout-out to the first Milwaukee pizza place to finally offer Daya and tell them that that will be the only place that he'll be buying pizza from.
What's it called?
That was my question. He said, it doesn't exist. It's a call to action.
Oh.
So, Milwaukee, get the F on that.
Step it up.
Minneapolis has three pizza places that have Daya.
Yep.
We have Galactic, Pizza Luce, which has 37 locations. Not 37. What? 5-6 locations?
Yeah.
And Z Pizza, which has multiple locations also, which all offer Daya. So, come on, Milwaukee.
Yeah. We are kicking your butt.
You know, we don't need to have another rivalry. We've got enough Minnesota-Scani rivalries here.
Just come and join us in that.
So thanks to you guys for catching us on Facebook and writing in. That was really fun. And maybe next time we'll post a little bit further in advance, like maybe 24 hours in advance of our recording. But, hey, what are you guys doing sitting inside at this time of day on this day of the week? It's a beautiful 90-what degree day in the Twin Cities? Humid.
95, I think.
It's gross,
yeah,
as usual.
It's hot.
I'm actually looking forward to recording episodes when it's, like, fall and not 100 degrees in here.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome.
It will be.
All right. I think that's all we have today.
Yeah.
That was a pretty serious episode up until the end. And
yeah.
Next time will be a little bit lighter, but it's a very important topic. It needs to be acknowledged, so.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.